Dr. Malone, can you hear us?
I can.
Oh.
Can you hear me?
Yes, absolutely. I apologize for having kept you waiting for so long. We were just listening to a German writer, social scientist, and peace scientist who explained to us what is really going on here. He gave us the entire picture, all the little pieces of the puzzle.
And I wish I wasn't so stupid and I could speak German. Because clearly Ulrich was providing fascinating information about the censorship and the international campaign to control the media, the message, the information that people have available to them. And I can only capture the vague idea of what he was speaking about very passionately. But it sounds to me like he's even more aggravated about this than I am. So I wish I could have understood him better. Hello to Germany. I just wanted to say, many years ago, as a younger scientist, I spent time in München with Beringer Mannheim and loved the Black Forest. And look forward to the next time I get to go there to drink beer. Here we have more important things. And again, I apologize to Dr. Mies that I was not able to understand what he had to say. I got a little bit of it.
You got the gist of it, I believe. You heard him talk about this gigantic psyop. You heard him talk about Biedermann. I'm pretty sure you understand what that means.
Yeah. Okay. I'm grateful for the many Europeans that have reached out to me. I've been surprised, overwhelmed, and comforted by listening to my colleagues from Europe, from France, from Italy, from Germany, from the Netherlands, and Belgium, and Switzerland. If one can separate yourself from it a little bit, these are amazing times. And what we're seeing, I would imagine, resonates particularly with German intellectuals. German intellectuals are uniquely positioned, I think, to understand and be able to perceive through the fog of what's going on and understand it in historical context. I think Europe desperately needs your leadership right now. And thank you for the opportunity to speak to you.
Thank you very much for coming on to this program, or this session rather. I think many of the viewers of our sessions have seen the video in which you and two other scientists, I think even the journalist is really a scientist, spoke with each other about what is going on here. And I think many, many people were really, really impressed by what you had to say. Can you give us your background? I just introduced you as the inventor of the mRNA technique. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. It goes back to, it's a little embarrassing. It goes back to 1987 through 1989 when I was a graduate student at the Salk Institute. So I was only 28, 29 years old then. And I was working in a gene therapy lab of Dr. Inder Verma at the Salk. We could tell that story, but it would take up our remaining time. I don't wish to focus. I'm not somebody who seeks media attention. The Brett Weinstein podcast with Steve Kirsch that you're referring to has thrust me into international attention. I often interact with the press, but almost always on background. I'm a professional and a consultant, have been for many years, particularly in the area of biodefense and medical countermeasure development for infectious and emerging infectious diseases. I've been through many, many outbreaks, often at the very tip of the spear, is the phrase we use. And for me, this is another outbreak. It's the biggest so far, but the dynamics that one sees are common across these. Unfortunately, the community, the world health community and public health leadership community, never seems to learn the lessons. We just repeat the same mistakes again and again. But this one is fairly unique for just the reason, in my experience, that Dr. Mies was just sharing with us this information. I don't know how else to say it. Information warfare is really kind of what we're dealing with. And its coordination and the ability to perceive this integration between the pharmaceutical industry, the government, and the media, and the new media, big tech, is something that I have not seen before. And I don't think any of us have. The censorship is profound. And if you can disassociate yourself from the moment and the passion, which I share with Dr. Mies, but I try to keep it inside my head and stay balanced, because if I was to become that passionate, I think I would explode. I have to keep it bottled up and stay in, I'm really focused on trying to stay data-based, evidence-based, and balanced through this. It's easy to, I'm surrounded by people who are coming to me with various conspiracy theories. And I try hard to stay focused just on the scientific data that I can observe and interpreting the meaning of those data, whether they're scientific data or they're data from the media, specific facts, not conspiracies and theories. There seems to be a situation where there's a bunch of, you can almost think of it, if you were to lay out a diagram, a bunch of modules of information that seem paradoxical or counterintuitive. And these conspiracies often will seize on one of these bits of information and then associate it with all these other bits of information and craft a narrative. But those narratives are often not grounded in empiric data. They run off into speculation. And I'm concerned about, I try really hard not to do that. So this Weinstein podcast, as you mentioned, thrust me into the space, but my history is 30 years of both discovery bench research in polynucleotide delivery, genetic vaccination, gene therapy. And then after 9/11, I transitioned to focusing on biodefense and advanced development rather than discovery. Advanced development being the term here in the States we use for the process after the transition to the formal environment of regulatory affairs, clinical development, and the more controlled project management, all those things. So that's what I've been. I'm quite skilled now in that set of skills, and also in working very closely with the government. I currently the U.S. Department of Defense, Defense Threat Reduction Agency, is a major client for me. I work on contracts for MIT Lincoln Lab and Leidos, which is a large scientific contractor to the U.S. government. I historically was at the tip of the spear in bringing forward the Public Health Agency Canada vaccine that we now call the Merck vaccine for Ebola, and was the one that brought Merck in on that. So for me, I've been through many, many outbreaks, both as a in the role of being a discovery research scientist and in the role of being a specialist in this advanced development process, often working very closely with the U.S. government. And over my lifetime, I've captured well over $2 billion for in grants and contracts for my customers to work on government projects and develop products. In this current outbreak, I've captured about $130 million. So I understand the government. I interface with the legislature here. We call it the Hill is the slang, senators and congresspeople. I interface with the FDA. I used to live down in Atlanta. I've spent many, many hours watching, you know, participating in the ACIP meetings. I understand the gears and levers of how all this works and doesn't work. So there's a background. I hope that was helpful.
Thank you. Let me just quickly translate this, please. Also, Robert Malone ist tatsächlich, war auch hier in Deutschland, hat sich darüber gefreut, im Schwarzwald hat es ihm sehr gut gefallen, würde gerne irgendwann wiederkommen, hat einiges von dem, was Ulrich Mies gesagt hat, so ein bisschen nachvollzogen, sagt, ja, er sieht das ähnlich, aber er kommt aus einer ganz anderen Richtung. Er kommt mitten aus dem Getriebe selbst, hat tatsächlich die mRNA-Technik erfunden. Das ist ziemlich unfassbar, dass er jetzt hier ist. Er sagt, er ist sehr dankbar, nachdem es einen Podcast gegeben hat mit ihm und zwei anderen Wissenschaftlern. Einer davon ist der Journalist gewesen. Er ist sehr dankbar dafür, dass aufgrund offenbar dieser plötzlichen Berühmtheit, die ihm ein bisschen unangenehm ist, weil er sagt, ich will eigentlich gar nicht in die Öffentlichkeit, dass er insbesondere hier aus Europa eine Menge Zuspruch bekommen hat. Er sagt, das sind hier ziemlich erstaunliche Zeiten. Er löst sich so ein bisschen von dem, was an Negativen eben zu hören gewesen ist. Er sagt, wenn ich jetzt so emotional reagieren würde, dann würde er verrückt werden, würde er explodieren, hat er gesagt. Deswegen versucht er immer, sich an den Fakten festzuhalten, sagt aber auch gerade, was diese Fakten angeht, da seien die deutschen Intellektuellen wahrscheinlich in einer außergewöhnlichen Position, um durch den Nebel zu sehen. Ich nehme an, er meint damit auch den Nebel, der uns eben von Ulrich Mies geschildert worden ist. 87 oder 89, da hat er im Salk Institute gearbeitet und dabei wohl die mRNA-Technik entwickelt. Seither ist er Berater, ein Professional, also ein selbstständiger, freiberuflich tätiger Berater, macht sehr viel bei Bioverteidigung und kennt sich, hat eigentlich alle großen Outbreaks mitgemacht. Die Dynamik dieses wohl größten Ausbruchs einer Krankheit, so sagt er, ist allerdings schon besonders. Immer, so sagt er, werden dieselben Fehler, in diesem Fall auch von der WHO, immer wieder und wieder werden dieselben Fehler gemacht. Hier ist das Besondere, auch aus seiner Sicht, dass wir es hier mit einem, so hat er es konkret genannt, mit einem Informationskrieg zu tun haben. Das hätte es so noch nicht gegeben. Ein Informationskrieg, der von einer integrierten Gruppe bestehend aus den Regierungen, den Medien und insbesondere den neuen, den sozialen Medien besteht. Aber er weist nochmal darauf hin, er versucht mit beiden Beinen aber in den Fakten stehen zu bleiben, weil sonst würde er verrückt werden. Er kümmert sich um evidenzbasierte Tatsachen, die er uns hier schildern kann. Und er versucht, von den Conspiracy Theories wegzubleiben. Viele Informationen, so hat er eben gesagt, erscheinen paradox, widersprüchlich. Und daraus entstehen dann häufig Spekulationen, denen er nicht so ohne weiteres folgen will. Hat eben noch mal erklärt, seit 9/11 ist er in der Bioverteidigung tätig, arbeitet für die Regierung, auch für MIT. Das ist eine sehr renommierte Universität. Mit denen hat er auch einen Vertrag. Und er war auch an der Vorfront, als es um Ebola zum Beispiel ging und dort ein Impfstoff, der heute Merck-Impfstoff genannt wird, erfunden wurde. Er hat auch für die Forschung an diesem Corona-Ausbruch, ich glaube, 130 Millionen bekommen. Also nicht er für sich, sondern natürlich, um hier zu forschen. Und er hat eben auch nochmal erklärt, er kennt die gesamten Techniken, die Funktionsweisen der Regierung, insbesondere in Washington. Er ist mittendrin. Okay, that's a pretty good introduction. Wolfgang?
May I have a question?
Sure.
Yes, may I have a question? You know, when you know a lot about weapons, bioweapons, and you think of viruses, and you think of dangerous viruses, lethal viruses, do you think such a virus would be successful if you just set it free to the population? That it could kill many people?
So there are... This is a sensitive topic. It's the question, and of course you're touching on the question of the lab leak hypothesis versus intentional release, is the subtext to your question.
Yeah.
When we think about this within my world of biodefense and potential biowarfare threats, and we have to think about these new threats of garage biology is a slang, and the use of CRISPR-Cas9 to enable relatively unskilled individuals with relatively crude facilities, that one can readily reconstruct some of the great bio threats of history now with fairly simple technology. And this is the problem. When one thing that's important to understand as we think about these things is that the biowarfare treaty has a gap. The gap is for what's called incapacitating agents. So lethal agents are prohibited. Incapacitating agents are not. So this yields a threat scenario for engineered viruses or weaponized viruses that cause severe symptoms but generally don't cause death. In the problem with any of these infectious disease release scenarios, particularly if you're going to use a virus that's transmitted by aerosol like this one, or an engineered influenza, we can go on and on, as opposed to, say, a mosquito-transmitted agent, is the risk that the agent gets free of the constraints of the theater that one is going to introduce it to. And clearly, in this case, If this was a leak or an intentional release, and if you're coming from a position of being agnostic about the origin of the virus, that's my position. Is I know enough information to know that I can't determine between the various scenarios. I know that it is possible that this is an intentional release. I know it's possible that it's a laboratory leak. I know it's theoretically possible that it is a natural crossover zoonotic infection into human host that then has completed further rounds of replication and refining its infectivity. But a scenario could be made that an agent like this, a coronavirus, could have been released into Wuhan, the industrial heart of China, and have a reasonable expectation that the Chinese would have been able to contain it, because they've invested literally billions annually in PCR diagnostics and other surveillance capabilities because of their sensitization after the SARS outbreak, so the preceding coronavirus. And so it's known that the People's Republic of China has made major investments in identification, detection, containment for coronaviruses specifically. Now, remember I said that I try to really hard to stay fact-based. So for me, there are multiple hypotheses, and there is insufficient data to differentiate between those, to rule one out or rule one in. But I could imagine a scenario where this virus could have been released into that environment with a reasonable expectation that the PRC could contain it. Obviously, that isn't what happened. There wasn't containment. But if your question is, could this have been a intentional release? I think that's the subtext of your question. I can't rule that out. Have I answered your question?
Yeah. I just referred to your experiences with outbreaks. And if you have natural outbreaks, you sometimes may have very dangerous viruses, like those of Lassa fever or Marburg fever or such things.
Yes.
And when aren't they self-limiting because the host is dying or the host is severely knocked out so that he cannot travel and that he isn't it very easy to limit the outbreak with such diseases? In the opposite is a virus you almost don't recognize and it will spread easily. But I think when you have a dangerous virus, a life-threatening virus, that there is a self-limitation because it kills the host and it stops the host having contacts, and so it stops the host to spread the virus. Don't you know something about this?
Of course, this is true. And in the case of the West African Ebola outbreak, this was the logic of the World Health Community, frankly, was that Ebola was such a self-limiting virus. What the World Health Community did not appreciate is the burial practices that were common in that region of prolonged mourning, touching and kissing and otherwise contacting the infected deceased, and the persistence of live virus on the body of the deceased. And the truth is, as it sounds like you're probably well aware, we like to tell ourselves the story that the vaccine was what enabled the containment. And there's some discussion around that, but I think most sober epidemiologists would say that the reason that it was contained was through education and modification of burial practices.
Yes, I think so too. I have observed, I have a friend in Conakry, and he observed it, and he was always informing me what's going on. And it was already in the early, I think it March, when the Ebola breakout in Conakry or around around Conakry started, there were capacities to analyze and to have a diagnosis, to have PCR and this, and it was not used. Because the UN said this is something the WHO has to do, and they lost some month until they started the diagnosis, which helped the spread of the virus. And I am suspicious that there were some profiteers from this spreading, those who want to develop some vaccine and want to put on the market some vaccines. What do you think about that?
So there are many that share your concern. And many, these are examples of the modules of information or observations. There are many of these observations having to do with Dr. Fauci, Mr. Gates, their interactions with the World Health Community, et cetera, that can be assembled almost like maybe in Germany you also have Legos. So these little snap together things, and you can assemble a variety of theories about this, but the intrinsic commercial conflicts of interest that exist certainly give rise to many opportunities to build theories about these networks of self-interest. This is one of the problems I mentioned at the start about the integration of government, world health, pharmaceutical industry, mainstream media, and big tech. These are all integrated now, and it's easy to draw lines of self-interest. I prefer to try to live in what can we do now? What's happened has happened. And personally, I think that the simplest explanation, Occam's razor, is incompetence and groupthink rather than centralized nefariousness. However, I've worked for pharma. I've dealt with pharma all my life. And I've dealt with Pfizer and Merck and others. And my experiences are that one should never discount the willingness of pharma to engage in practices which advance their commercial interests. I'm choosing my words carefully.
Yes.
So do I think that Pfizer has strong ethical boundaries that would prohibit it?
I could ask you another different question. Would it have run the same way if the vaccination production and the research on vaccination would be in the hand of a state and would just be a factor of cost and not a factor of gaining something?
So it was in the hand of the state, the United States, where the boundaries between the commercial interests and the government are completely blurred.
Yeah.
We use the term regulatory capture. It goes beyond regulatory capture. The pharmaceutical industry accounts for 25% of the spending of the United States in total. And they've used that money to capture the legislature.
I understand.
And they've captured the FDA.
We can hardly imagine this model that only the state from the taxpayers does something. This is very difficult to imagine nowadays. I understand, yes.
Yeah, it no longer exists.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is just the way things are. Just to illustrate, so I'm not sure what all of you understand is I'm very close to the fire, so I'm able to see things.
Sure.
The Moderna vaccine is actually the NIH vaccine. NIH engineered that. Moderna is a company that was funded by DARPA. The contracts between the NIH and Moderna were signed in December of 2019 to develop the vaccine. And this idea that the state is separate from industry in the United States is really no longer tenable. And I think this is an example that the German intellectuals are very aware of.
Yeah. Allow me again.
I don't need to say more.
Allow me to translate this, because this is really important. Wolfgang Wodak hat eben gefragt, wenn das, würde man eine solche Plandemie, davon gehen wir ja inzwischen aus, wirklich durchführen mit einem wirklich gefährlichen Virus, oder macht es nicht vielmehr keinen Sinn, einen wirklich gefährlichen Virus einzusetzen, weil der ja sofort seinen Host umbringen würde und dann sich auch nicht weiter verbreiten würde. Dr. Malone sagte dann, ja, also die Experimente, die Forschung mit tödlichen Krankheitserregern, dies ist verboten. Das dürfte dann auch für die Gain-of-Function-Geschichten gelten. Die sind verboten. Aber Krankheitserreger, die einen nur handlungsunfähig machen, die sind nicht, also die Forschung damit, die sind nicht verboten. Er hat dann über Ebola erklärt, dass Ebola so ein wohl eher wirklich gefährliches Virus war, aber die WHO hat damals wohl nicht gemerkt, dass der Erreger in dem Fall zu lange auch noch überlebt, auch auf den Toten. Am Ende sei es nicht die Impfung gewesen, die zur Beendigung der Pandemie geführt hat, sondern die Aufklärung der Bevölkerung, unter anderem über Hygiene, was geholfen hat. Er ist auch noch eingegangen darauf, war das nun ein Laborleak oder ist das was Natürliches gewesen? Er hat immer wieder betont, er weiß wirklich nicht, woher es kommt. Alles ist aber möglich. Und er hat dann gesagt, es kann sein, dass der Krankheitserreger tatsächlich gezielt nach Wuhan geleakt wurde in das Industriezentrum von China, mit der vernünftigen Erwartung, dass die das schon unter Kontrolle bringen werden, weil China sehr viel investiert hat in die Erkennung, in die frühe Erkennung und Bekämpfung solcher Krankheiten. Wolfgang hat dann gefragt, kann es nicht sein, dass die verzögerte Reaktion oder das Unterlassen von Behandlungen wie, ich glaube, das hast du jetzt nicht gesagt, Wolfgang, aber ich sage es nochmal, Vitamin D oder Ivermectin oder sowas, kann das nicht auch seinen Grund darin haben, dass die Impfstoffhersteller oder dass man den Impfstoffherstellern Geld verschaffen wollte? Ja, sagt er. Das ist eine, Dr. Malone sagt, das ist eine der Theorien, die man hier vertreten kann. Das Problem hier ist tatsächlich, das hat er jetzt mehrfach gesagt, dass wir eine völlige Integration von Regierung, Mainstream-Medien, der pharmazeutischen Industrie und von Big Tech haben. Also man kann das eine nicht mehr vom anderen unterscheiden. Die simpelste Erklärung dafür, was hier läuft, ist, dass wir es mit völliger Inkompetenz zu tun haben. Aber es kann natürlich auch, wir haben es ja eben bei Ulrich Mies ganz anders gehört, völlig andere Motive. Und jetzt wird er sehr, sehr vorsichtig und er sagt, er hat auch deutlich darauf hingewiesen, ich wähle meine Worte jetzt bewusst sehr, sehr vorsichtig. Er sagt, wir sollten niemals die Bereitschaft der Impfkonzerne der pharmazeutischen Industrie unterschätzen, einfach nur etwas aus rein kommerziellen Gründen zu machen. Das ist eine sehr vorsichtige Beschreibung. Wolfgang fragte dann, was ist denn, wenn wir das Ganze in den Händen des Staates gelassen hätten, diese Impfprogramme? Nochmal sagt er, wir können hier gar nicht mehr, das war ja in den Händen des Staates, nämlich des amerikanischen Staates, aber wir können überhaupt nicht mehr unterscheiden zwischen dem Privaten und dem Staat, dass die Grenzen sind völlig miteinander verschwommen. Es gibt den Staat so nicht mehr, hat er gesagt. Er sei sehr nah dran am Feuer, deswegen kann er alles sehr genau sehen. Und jetzt hat er ein Beispiel gebracht. Moderna ist im Grunde der NIH, das National Institute of Health. Moderna ist eine Gründung vom Verteidigungsministerium, von DARPA. Und da kann man also keinen Unterschied mehr sehen. Dr. Malone, we have an expert here who's asking me to ask you a question, if that is okay with you. The expert is our expert on PCR tests, Professor Kemmerer. She's asking the following. What is your opinion about costs versus benefits in the current COVID vaccine crisis? And how do you think, or what do you think about the attenuated inactivated vaccines like Sinovac or the different ones from India like BV-152 as compared with the mRNA and vector vaccines with respect to safety and efficacy?
Thank you for that question. And I appreciate we're moving more into my comfort zone with that question. But there is one follow-up that I forgot to mention that relates to the prior.
Yeah.
As just further on this integration, one should understand that royalty payments from Moderna go back to NIH and specifically go into payments that supplement the salaries of the approximately six NIH employees that are listed on the patent. So there's money that comes back to Tony Fauci's organization and money that comes back directly to his employees. So I think this is important to understand that this integration is quite thorough and involves financial transactions that are very transparent.
Yeah, so we have the same here, that basically the BioNTech patent is, that's held by CureVac, and the German government has heavily invested into CureVac. So, I mean, we also have this kind of thing going on here.
Yeah, so that seems to be a something happening in Western democracies, and I'm sure it's all for the best intentions, but sometimes best intentions have unintended consequences. Now, getting to the question about cost effectiveness, I have to disclose a conflict of interest. I am a consultant to an organization called Reliance in India. Reliance is the largest conglomerate in India. And I consult with them to their vaccines branch. And I have been involved in supporting the development of their vaccine candidate, which is about to enter phase one this summer. And it's specifically designed for the rural poor of India and the emerging economies. And it is a fermentation-based product that employs two different antigens, that neither of which are the intact spike protein. It's a classic and traditional subunit vaccine with more traditional adjuvants. So I do receive this stipend monthly from this company to help support them. And their goal is to produce a product at extremely low cost and high yield because of the needs of the rural poor. I personally, even though this vaccine technologies involving RNA come from my bench originally many years ago, I'm very sensitive to the price point of these products. I was very skeptical all the way through that these products were a viable solution to meet worldwide needs. I'm also very skeptical of those who believe that we will be able to somehow eradicate this virus from the human population. I think this is not aligned with the experience in epidemiology. I like to cite, if this was possible, we would have done it with polio. We did succeed with smallpox, but smallpox is very visible. And it is quite striking in its effects. This virus is much more subtle, and the vaccines are not sterilizing in the sense that they don't prevent virus replication and transmissibility. So a lot of this underlying logic for universal vaccination, in my opinion, is not aligned with the data. It's not consistent with what's known. So in sum, I concur that the cost effectiveness of the mRNA vaccines in particular, and to some extent the adenoviral vaccines and their suitability for global distribution and use is not aligned with the mission, the need. And I believe that these technologies, particularly the mRNA, are very suitable for rapid response and potential containment of initial outbreaks of a newly emerging infectious disease or engineered pathogens. I think that we are really pushing a technology into a application that is for which it's not well suited. But that's, in my opinion, not the main problem here. So the problem with the Russian and Chinese products and many of these subunit products, as you know, is their efficacy for prevention of disease and death. And please recognize that I'm not aware of any of these vaccines being adequately characterized in terms of their impact on transmissibility, which is the endpoint that we need for herd immunity or containment. But in general, my opinion is that the subunit vaccines and more traditional vaccine approach, including the Novavax product, which I have no conflict of interest there, but I think that these products need to be moved into the clinic if these other products merit emergency use authorization, certainly the Novavax product merits emergency use authorization. And I believe quite strongly that these genetic vaccines, this includes the adenovirus expressing full-length spike, are first-generation products that have significant intrinsic risk, were rushed out, and need to be re-engineered to mitigate those risks. Now, Wolfgang is holding up his hand, and I'm going to stop talking so that I can listen to him.
Yes, thank you very much. Do you remember, or for sure you remember, those trials with the SARS virus, with the first SARS virus in, it was in 2004, I think, when they started, or no, 2005, when they started to develop virus and vaccination against the SARS virus. And there were some animal studies, and they were stopped because of very bad results, because of the ADE. And why do you think, or how long do you think we have to observe, or what do we have to do to be sure that this could never happen again? This was a conventional virus, I think, conventional vaccine that were developed there. It were not genetically, no mRNA virus or something like that. So how can you be sure that ADE does not happen with the corona vaccinations you are dealing with? And how long do you take to be sure? How many studies, how many years, or how many months of observations do you think you need to be sure that it cannot happen?
So as you know, the history of coronavirus vaccines in human and veterinary has been one of repeatedly encountering antibody-dependent enhancement, or ADE, during product development. There are two cases that I know of licensed veterinary vaccines, one for bovine coronavirus and one for feline infectious peritonitis virus, which is another coronavirus, that have mitigated the ADE sufficiently that they become licensed for those veterinary indications. And as you correctly say, the history of human coronavirus vaccine development has not been encouraging. This is why when I made a threat assessment after I was contacted by a U.S. Officer who was in Wuhan in the latter part of 2019 and gave me a phone call in the first week of 2020 and warned me that I needed to get my team spun up. This is why I did a threat assessment and focused on repurposed drugs, is specifically because of the antibody-dependent enhancement history of coronavirus vaccine development. How long? So we're past the point, let's say this, the clinical studies were not designed, and one could argue were specifically designed not to detect, if one was a cynic, they were specifically designed not to detect ADE. So the phase 1, 2, 3 studies that were performed were not structured in a way that they would detect ADE should it happen. I think that I continue to monitor the data, and there are ghosts in the data that suggest that there is a possibility that there's some level of ADE going on. I was very concerned about it at the start, but it is not. It does not appear to be as florid as, say, dengue virus, where it's very easily detected. It's the classic case of ADE. So we have these the variants that are emerging in the population, Delta being the latest that there's the attention on, are not showing a marked increase in anything that could be interpreted as an ADE signal, at least to my eyes. Why is this? Could it be that these vaccines are provoking such strong cellular responses that they're mitigating this risk? That is a hypothesis. And the genetic vaccine strategy with both the adenovirus and the mRNA is specifically intended to mitigate or to enable cellular cytotoxic responses. That's the logic for genetic vaccination, is to get a more balanced TH1 and TH2 response. So maybe that's why we're not seeing it. It doesn't mean that it's not there. The epidemiologic data, the safety data that we have is so poor. It is the self-reported things, and a cynic or conspiracy theorist might say that was intentional. I wouldn't say that, but what we can observe is the quality of the safety databases are very poor, and they don't support the level of detailed analysis that we would wish to be able to have. I think that many of these arguments about safety would have been readily resolved had we had more rigorous capture of safety events rather than this self-reporting system. And we wouldn't have to argue about these things. It was a decision made initially at the FDA. They had the regulatory latitude to require much more rigorous capture of data during emergency use authorization by the pharmaceutical companies, and they elected not to do that. So there are some fundamental, if in my opinion, if we go back to where does this problem start with, I believe that the regulatory authorities have not done a good job, gently put.
You said it very poorly, thank you.
And many of the controversies and conspiracy theories would have been alleviated, would never have developed, had the regulatory authorities been rigorous. And if I can build off of this, to illustrate, most of these regulatory agencies rely on checklists. I'm sorry, it's we wish that they were more intellectual, and there are some super-duper German affiliates that institutes that bring strong intellect. Yeah, bring considerable intellect.
I asked them concerning side effects, And they gave me the impression that they very much rely on the data they get from the producer of the vaccines, and that they don't have their own independent controls. So this is a big risk.
It is a, it's a major problem. And the history of Pfizer, to be blunt, is not one of rigor and transparency. There are many, many examples of illustrating this, but getting back to the fact, they have these checklists, and for whatever reason, there was a decision starting at the FDA to apply the checklist for vaccines, for traditional vaccines, and not to apply the gene therapy checklist. And this is part of this enormous push to not to discourage the use of the term gene therapy technology applied to vaccines. But I can assure you, if we go back to the root of when I was a graduate student and we had these discoveries, and then Dinko Valerio left the lab and created Crucell. So both the ad-vectored vaccine and the mRNA vaccine come from the same laboratory initially in the 80s. Okay. They are gene therapy applied to vaccines. So what the regulators didn't do was apply both the gene therapy checklist and the vaccine checklist. If they had
they
done that.
They changed the definition. Yeah, they changed the definition by law in 2009 because they had plans to do like this already then. They changed the definition of the German pharmaceutical law, and they changed the definition in the European pharmaceutical law, where they accepted the use of nucleic acid if you wanted to take it for fight infections. It is called vaccination, and they abandoned the term gene therapy if this indication fighting infections was there. So it was just a definition by the lawmakers.
I didn't know this.
For sure,
thank
some interest, some
me.
Industrial interest behind it.
Let me just finish this thought, okay? The consequence of this decision is that the regulators have treated the gene therapy-based products as traditional vaccines. And they require, if you understand pharmaceuticals, they require rigorous characterization of the quantity, purity, et cetera, of the material in the needle. But if you think this through, the active agent is the expressed protein antigen. And normally, one would characterize for a traditional vaccine exactly how much of that expressed protein, that protein antigen, is produced and where it goes and for how long.
Yes.
In these cases, the regulators have not done that. So we have no information about the levels of spike produced, the distribution of spike produced, and the duration of spike produced.
You don't know even the targets.
We don't know the cells that they're infecting or transfecting. So, well, technically transducing or transfecting. So what we do know is that the adenoviral vectors were designed for prolonged high-level protein expression. That's what they were selected for. The mRNA logic is that it enables a shorter-term drug-like activity, and then the RNA is degraded. But we don't know what those kinetics are. So the regulators have, in many ways, in looking at, for instance, the Japanese Common Technical Document, there's data in there that, to my eyes, as a specialist in this, have been designed to give the right answer, the answer that's desired by the pharmaceutical company, not the scientifically rigorous answer. And I believe that the only explanation I can come up with is that the regulators didn't have it, and it's hard to understand this because it was global. that the regulators didn't have the sufficient background to comprehend the data that they were shown and its deficiencies. Now, I should let the team translate. I apologize for running over, but I wanted to make this key point that we do not understand how much protein is being made by any of these genetic vaccine technologies, where it's being made, and for how long is it being made. And I believe that is a major oversight. Yes.
And we know in the meantime that contrary to what the makers of these vaccines told us, it doesn't stay at the injection site, but rather it moves pretty much everywhere in your body, right?
To some extent. And this gets to my point. So what Pfizer, I've only seen the Pfizer CTD that was released from Japan. Okay, so I can't say what Moderna has done or what J&J or Oxford / AZ has done. I haven't seen those dossiers. In the case of Pfizer, they characterize the pharmacodistribution is the technical term of the active drug material and the expression of the transgene, the encoded RNA, not using the final drug product, but rather using a surrogate. So this is red flag number one. That's not usually allowed. So they didn't characterize the expression of spike in the animal models. They characterized the expression of luciferase. Luciferase is the protein that makes the firefly tail glow. I think you see these in the forests here in, yes, okay, good. So it's very sensitive reporter gene because it produces photons and we have photon cameras. Normally, the way that that is characterized is you dissect the animal and you lyse the cells in each sample, and then you can calculate precisely how much protein. But remember, we're not even talking about the spike protein. We're talking about the firefly protein. There's a parlor trick that can be done with luciferase, wherein you image the whole animal. So you put the photon camera over the whole animal. I've done this. It's really neat. You inject the luciferin. The animal is either sacrificed or anesthetized. And you can see the photons come all the way through the animal and pick it up on your camera. And you get a glow patch at the site of the expression. However, you can appreciate these photons are having to pass through the tissue, muscle, bone, skin, hair, everything else. They get scattered all over the place. And so this very neat trick, which is, you know, great for covers of journals, is really biased to only picking up the signal where there is the most expression. It's the least sensitive method, yet that's the method that Pfizer used for their dossier. So based on that, Pfizer asserts that the expression is localized just to the site of injection. But in fact, what they did is they ran a highly biased assay. And this illustrates my point. I think that the regulatory authorities weren't not sufficiently technically expert to comprehend that we have an expression in the States pulling the wool over your eyes, to comprehend that Pfizer had selected the least sensitive method to characterize the distribution of expression of a surrogate protein rather than the actual drug product.
Would it be possible to mark with a C14 or some radioactive substance to mark the vaccine and to control the distribution by that means?
They did look at the distribution of RNA using tritium. And in fact, that does show while the majority stays in the local region in the small number of non-good laboratory practice study rodents, a substantial fraction does distribute it throughout the animal. What has many people alarmed is that if you imagine, so I have to get into the technical a little bit, but I'm going to make it easy. If you imagine that these particles are like an envelope and RNA is the letter inside, the envelope are fats. And these are chemically synthesized fats. They characterize in the Pfizer dossier, they characterize the distribution of these fats. And what has many people concerned, I'm choosing my words, is that about 12% of those lipids concentrate in the ovaries of the female animals, but not in the testis of the male animals. This is often misinterpreted as a marker of where the protein is expressed, and people have asserted that this means that we have spike protein being expressed in the ovaries. That's not true. But we can say, based on those non-GLP rodent studies, limited number of rodents, that there's a sign that the lipids are preferentially concentrated in ovarian tissue. And, of course, that has implications. This feeds back onto the point in this checklist that's used for vaccines by most regulators. With traditional vaccines, genotoxicity and reproductive toxicity are often not required. With the gene therapy product, they absolutely are required. In this case, by Pfizer's own admission in their protocol, but it's also in the CTD, the reproductive toxicology studies were not done rigorously, and there were no genotoxicity studies done. So we have, to be technically accurate, we have evidence in non-good laboratory practice studies of concentration of the synthetic lipid into ovarian tissue and spleen and bone marrow and liver and other places you might expect it to distribute to. But the ovarian tissue is particularly concerning. Now I'm being told that I'm running out of time here. By my wife, forgive me. But have I answered your question?
Wolfgang.
Yes, I think it was a very, very important message you just gave. And I think it's a fundamental critics of what we are experiencing with how the use of billions of people are vaccinated with the stuff, which is not thoroughly examined before. And I've never experienced such thing in my life as a doctor. And all standards we know and we have practiced for tens of years, they are opposite to that. And it is not to be understood with medical ethics what is just happening now.
Precisely. That is my core argument, is that with all of this pressure from governments and the press and the media, and the censorship, we are failing to meet the fundamentals of medical ethics that go back to the Nuremberg trials. There must be complete disclosure of risk. Those risks must be comprehended. And there has to be free willingness to accept the product. It cannot be coerced or enticed. Those are bedrock principles. And these are currently experimental products. And for some reason, governments around the world have decided that they can jettison these fundamental ethics hastily implement these vaccines and do it in a universal way. And this is another core problem, is that the normal practice is that we do risk-benefit analysis stratified by special populations, adults, elderly, children, adolescents, pregnant women, yes, etc. But there's been this push that we take, if you follow the logic, we're applying the aggregated risk that is almost completely concentrated in the elderly and the obese and some special populations. We're applying that risk to the entire population and using that to justify vaccinating the entire population. with the logic that this will enable herd immunity. But it won't enable herd immunity because the vaccines are not sterilizing for the virus. And the whole logic, when you examine the underlying logic of what is being promoted, it falls apart. And this is what gives rise to the conspiracy theories, because clearly this logic that we've applied for vaccine development over decades, as you correctly say, is not being followed.
I was working for Transparency International, and I was never called a transparency theorist while I was thinking of preventing corruption, because we need suspicion to find corruption and to look, to see things through. It's necessary, it's normal, and it's a feedback we need as a society. But what I see now is that we have in Germany, we have institutions like the Institute for Quality and Economic Benefit in Health Systems. They are very good and very famous scientists working there. They always had the function to see benefit and damage and to balance it. And they were bypassed in this whole time with all the things happening with COVID-19. They were not asked, although the government has them as an instrument, they were not asked. And they were just bypassed, and they were bypassed with the distancing. Yeah. They were bypassed with the mask, and it would be all their task to answer us the questions. They were just not asked.
So I'm afraid I must go now. I'm completely out of time, and I have a follow on Zoom. Yeah. I'll leave you to translate. Thank you for your time and interest, and wish all of us the best. And if I can be of assistance to you in the future, please let me know how I can help you.
Thank you very much for your time. Thank you very much for your compassion. Even though you're evidence-based, it's obvious that you're a compassionate man. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Ich übersetze das Ganze jetzt mal, meine Fresse. Also, Dr. Malone hat eben noch mal, bevor er die nächsten Fragen beantwortet hat, versucht zu erklären, dass diese Public-Private-Geschichte vielleicht doch nicht so schlimm ist, und hat erläutert, dass Lizenzgebühren kann man sagen, die Moderna bekommt, zu einem Teil zurückgehen an das National Institute of Health. Er sagt, da kommt ja dann auch wieder Geld zurück aus dieser privaten Geschichte an die staatliche Institution, an Faucis Institution und seine, glaube ich, 6 Mitarbeiter oder was er da gesagt hat. Aber wir dürfen auch nicht vergessen, er hat es ja nun mehrfach betont, dass man keine wirkliche Unterscheidung mehr zwischen staatlichen und privaten Institutionen erkennen kann. Und darauf hat auch eben ausführlichst Ulrich Mies hingewiesen. Ulrike, Professor Kämmerer hat die Frage nach der Cost-Effectiveness, also wirkt das Zeug und wie sind die Kosten im Verhältnis dazu gestellt, also diese mRNA-Impfstoffe. Er hat dann erstmal gesagt, ich muss hier einen Conflict of Interest offenlegen, also einen Interessenkonflikt. Er arbeitet für, ich glaube, Reliance heißt es, einer der größten Konglomerate in England der pharmazeutischen Industrie. Da ist er Berater. Er ist da tätig, weil die an einem traditionellen Impfstoff für die ländlichen Armen arbeiten, erhält da monatliche Geldzahlungen, und er sagt, da ist das höchste oder einer der wichtigsten Gesichtspunkte bei der Entwicklung dieses traditionellen Impfstoffs die geringen Kosten. Und unter diesem Gesichtspunkt, sagt er, ist das mit der mRNA, dann funktioniert das nicht. Erstens sagt er, Corona kann man sowieso nicht ausrotten. Das, was hier behauptet wird, dass man mit Impfstoffen oder gar mit mRNA-Impfstoffen Corona ausrotten kann, das stimmt sowieso nicht. Die Impfungen werden keine Infektionen und keine Übertragung verhindern. Die Cost-Effectiveness der mRNA, insbesondere für den weltweiten Einsatz, hält er für nicht gegeben. es wäre vielleicht möglich gewesen, für eine Initial Response, also zunächst mal mit sowas zu reagieren. Aber wir müssen uns darüber im Klaren sein, dass das hier ein experimentelles Vorgehen ist. Das Problem mit den von Professor Kämmerer angesprochenen chinesischen Produkten ist, dass da überhaupt nichts bekannt ist, was die Verhinderung der Übertragbarkeit zum Beispiel angeht. Nochmal hat er gesagt, es geht hier bei der mRNA um genetische Impfstoffe. Das sind First-Generation-Produkte, die mit erheblichen Gefahren verbunden sind. Und er wird jetzt immer deutlicher, bis dahin sehr zurückhaltend. Erklärt, dass die Geschichte der Corona-Impfungen, also nicht mRNA, immer wieder zeigt bei Tieren, dass diese ADE, diese Antibody-Dependent Enhancement-Probleme auftauchen. Das sei, so hat er vorsichtig erneut formuliert, nicht wirklich ermutigend, was die Nutzung dieser mRNA, insbesondere Impfstoffe oder überhaupt von Impfstoffen, gegen Corona an Menschen darstellt. Die Studien, die wir gesehen haben von Pfizer, auf die konzentriert er sich erstens, waren so strukturiert, dass sie die Antibody-Enhancement-Probleme gar nicht erkennen konnten oder sollten. Weiter hat Dr. Malone erläutert, dass jetzt ja diese Mutanten, die Variants kommen, Delta, würde zeigen, dass es scheinbar gar keine Probleme wegen ADE gibt. Er sagt aber auch, wir sehen es nicht, das heißt aber nicht, dass es nicht da ist. Wir erinnern uns aber an Dr. Witkowski, mit dem wir auch gesprochen haben, der sagt, die Mutanten sind vielleicht ansteckender, aber deutlich weniger gefährlich. Die Qualität der Sicherheitstests, da haben wir ja auch nachgefragt. Wir hatten ja neulich Professor Wallach hier, der zusammen mit Dr. Rainer Clement, ich habe immer seinen Nachnamen vergessen, also der zweite Rainer habe ich irgendwann gesagt, aber die haben ja eine Studie zu den Impfnebenwirkungen veröffentlicht, sind dafür stark gescholten worden. Inzwischen ist das Ding zurückgezogen worden auf den Druck von Microsoft und Co. Das haben wir hier überdeutlich gehört. Dr. Malone sagt, die Qualität dieser Sicherheitstests ist sehr schlecht. Sehr schlecht. Die haben keinen guten Job gemacht, die Regulierungsbehörden. Deshalb entstehen diese ganzen Conspiracy Theories. Wir müssen überlegen, sind die vielleicht gerechtfertigt? Das ist jetzt mein Kommentar zu dem, was er gesagt hat. Die prüfen nämlich nur anhand von Checklisten. Also intellektuelle Arbeit wird da so gut wie nicht geleistet, sagt er. Und das Schlimme an den Checklisten ist, dass die für normale Impfungen ausgelegt sind, aber eben nicht für diesen genetischen Eingriff. Du, Wolfgang, hattest eben noch gefragt, hast darauf hingewiesen, dass die Definition für Impfungen in 2009 hier in Deutschland und auch in der EU geändert wurde. Jetzt ist alles, was man benutzt, um eine Infektion zu bekämpfen, plötzlich ein Impfstoff. Vorher waren das Gene Therapies, also Gentherapien. Dann haben wir über die darüber gesprochen, wo dieses Antigen überall auftaucht oder wo das Spike-Protein überall hingeht. Das weiß man alles noch nicht so richtig, aber es bleibt jedenfalls nicht an der Infektionsstelle. Das war, glaube ich, die wichtigste Botschaft aus diesem vorhin angesprochenen Podcast-Interview. Es läuft praktisch überall hin. Die Pharmakodistribution und die Expression des Transgenes. Und dann hat er noch erläutert, in den Tiermodellen hat Pfizer, er hat das so genannt, die Behörden, wohl auch die Öffentlichkeit getäuscht. To pull the wool over one's eyes, das ist over, heißt, man täuscht jemanden, indem sie eine nicht besonders sensitive Methode benutzt haben, um zu sehen, wo das Protein hinkommt und indem sie vor allem auch gar nicht das Spike-Protein selbst benutzt haben, sondern was anderes.
Rase benutzt, genau. Und die ist wohl, also das ist eine ziemlich simple Methode, wo dann quasi diese, das sind quasi das, was beim Glühwürmchen das Glühen ausmacht. Das ist das, so wie ich ihn verstanden hatte, dass das eben gemessen wurde, wo das jetzt rauskam, aber das ist überhaupt nicht das Spike-Protein, was sich ja an ganz anderen Stellen festmachen mag.
In Surrogatmark heißt es, ja.
Genau, sondern einfach nur, wo das dann irgendwie hochgepoppt ist, das hat man dann messen können.
Also
aber das
eine
ist
klare Täuschung.
Gar keine Aussage in Bezug auf das, was uns eigentlich interessiert, nämlich wo Spike-Protein
hingeht. Also wenn man sagt, dass er die Wolle über die Augen gezogen hat, klare Täuschung. Er ist immer deutlicher geworden. Das entspricht nicht Good Medical Practice, was hier gemacht worden ist. Es gibt keine ordentlichen Sicherheitsvorkehrungen. Jetzt wird er noch deutlicher. Es sind die fundamentalen medizinischen Ethiknormen verletzt worden. Der Nürnberger Kodex, welcher verlangt, dass die Menschen vollständig aufgeklärt werden müssen, bevor man solche Eingriffe, solche experimentellen Eingriffe, sagt er ja selbst, an ihnen vornimmt, wird hier am laufenden Meter verletzt. Alles ist in großer Hastigkeit über Bord geworfen worden. So sieht er das, aber er versucht natürlich immer, hat er ja auch oft gesagt, auf den Fakten zu bleiben. Ulrich Mies sieht das anders, da geht es nicht um Hastigkeit. Und das auch noch weltweit. Das ist besonders seltsam, denn normalerweise untersucht man, macht man Tests sozusagen nach Kohorten, nach Gruppen. Und hier wurde alles auf einmal gemacht. Im Ergebnis sagt er, die eigentlich vulnerable Bevölkerung, die Älteren mit Vorerkrankungen oder die stark adipösen Menschen, die ja nur eine vergleichsweise kleine Gruppe von Menschen ausmachen, die wurden als Begründung dafür genommen, dass man die gesamte Bevölkerung, die in weiten Teilen nicht mal ansatzweise betroffen ist, Kinder zum Beispiel gar nicht, diesem enormen Risiko dieser genetischen Experimente aussetzt. Ich glaube, damit haben wir es gut auf den Punkt gebracht.